Let's start. This is the sutta for today is called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search. And it's one of my favorite suttas, I think, in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's about the life of the Buddha. There's two suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya which are about the life of the Buddha. It's this one, and there is the Mahasatchaka Sutta, which is number 36. And if you read those two suttas in conjunction, you get a very good idea of the life of the Buddha, at least until his enlightenment, and also a little bit afterwards. So this is like the autobiography of the Buddha, in a sense. And there are some important reasons, I think, why it is useful to read the stories and read the suttas which talk about the biography of the Buddha. And the first one is that you get a kind of feeling for who the Buddha was. You get a kind of a relationship with him as a person. You see him, you understand his background, you understand where he came from, you understand what he did. And just like any person in this life who you know well, you know their background, you know what they're like, you know their personality, that's how you get close to them. In the same way, when you understand more about the Buddha in this way, you get a sense of being close to the Buddha. And I think that's important because it gives you that almost like a relationship in a sense. And the second reason why it is important is because the Buddha's life story is about how he attained enlightenment. And when you see this, you understand how the path actually works. Because this is about the path. This is about how the Buddha himself practiced the path to attain the same thing that we endeavor to attain in our life. So it gives an idea of how the Buddha actually practiced this. And the things that you see when you look at it that way, you start, first of all, you see that the Buddha was human just like we are humans. There was nothing supernatural about him. He had similar kind of defilements, similar kind of problems, similar situation that he was in. And so, first of all, you understand that you can relate to the Buddha as a human being. Just like he was, so we are. Just like we are, he was in the same way. And once you can relate to him as a human being, you also understand that the path that he was practicing is also the path that we can practice. So his life becomes like a example. It's kind of like a template for how we can also do our practice. And for these reasons, I find this sutta very inspiring and very useful, and something that we all can use for our reflection to advance on the path. So, having said that, I'm going to start. It's a long sutta. I will probably divide it in two halves, and I'll come back in a fortnight and do the second half next fortnight probably. There's probably too much material here to go through in one afternoon. So we'll see how things go anyway. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Savati for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, "Friend Ananda, it is a long time since we have heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could get to hear such a talk, friend Ananda. Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips." "Yes, friend," they replied. So as we go through this, if you have any questions, please just raise your hand and we take it as we go along here. Then, when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Savati and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, let us go to the eastern park, to the palace of Megara's mother, for the day's abiding." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern park, the palace of Megara's mother, for the day's abiding. I think the word palace here is a little bit too much. It's a pasada is the Pali word for this. And it's basically like a mansion maybe, or a large house. This is a type of building which is allowed for the Sangha. And I doubt that the Buddha would allow a palace for the Sangha. It sounds a little bit over the top, to be honest. So I think that is probably not quite correct. For the day's abiding, the meaning of the day's abiding is basically whatever meditation practice, whatever basically meditation practice that the Buddha or any other monk or nun would do after going for alms round, how they spend the rest of the day. That is what is meant here by the day's abiding. So basically means meditation practice. And the Buddha was renowned mostly for doing karuna or compassion practice after his enlightenment. He would sit down after the meal and he would enter what they call the Mahakaruna, the great compassion meditation, basically because he was a teacher for humanity and also more than humanity. So compassion was like the appropriate type of meditation for a teacher. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up out of the water and stood in one robe drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. The hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. Then the Blessed One went to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Now on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were sitting together in the hermitage discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One stood outside the door, waiting for the discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was underway? Is actually probably more correct translation than interrupted. Discussion that was underway. Venerable Sir, our discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself. Then the Blessed One arrived. So just briefly here, you see here, even the Buddha, he actually waits outside the door until the discussion is over before he coughs. Coughing is a kind of standard monastic etiquette to say that you are present. Whenever you go past somebody's kuti, even in Bodhinyana Monastery, you normally cough just to make it clear that you are there so that you know nobody gets a surprise or anything like that. So this goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And he actually waits outside the door. He doesn't, just because he's the boss, he doesn't just sort of go in there, but he follows the standard kind of polite procedure which was expected at the time. Okay, and then the Buddha goes on. Good bhikkhus, it is fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss the Dhamma. When you gather together, bhikkhus, you should do either of two things, hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence. So this idea of noble silence, what does that actually mean? And in the highest type of noble silence, according to the suttas, is the second jhana, because the second jhana is a state where the mind is completely 100% peaceful. And because it is 100% peaceful, it is the highest state of noble silence, according to the suttas. But I think what is meant here is basically you are silent because it is part of your practice as a Buddhist monk to be silent, because it's a beautiful state to have that sense of peace and tranquility. When it's not forced, you don't force it onto yourself, but you're silent simply because it is natural and because it is a beautiful state to abide in. It is, I would say, that if you have to force yourself to be silent, you have to sort of use your willpower, and it feels oppressive maybe and unpleasant, then it's not really noble silence. Noble silence is a state where you feel at ease and you feel happy and tranquil precisely because you are silent. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on. Bhikkhus, there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. It should actually be old age rather than aging. He seeks what is subject to old age. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. So this is the summary of the ignoble search. I'll go through this in detail first of all before I say anything more, at least the first one. And what may be said to be subject to birth? Wife and children are subject to birth, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to birth. These acquisitions, or belongings if you like, these belongings are subject to birth, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. So the first category here, the first thing that we're looking at here is birth. And as you will all know, in the first noble truth also starts off with birth as a first factor of suffering in the first noble truth. And here you have exactly the same sequence with birth coming first. And the reason why birth is mentioned here, of course, is precisely because it is part of this first noble truth of suffering. And the problem here is that you are, first of all, you are yourself subject to birth. You are, in other words, you are yourself subject to the suffering which comes with birth, which comes with renewed life in the future and all these things. And then instead of actually trying to find an end to that, finding a solution to that problem, you seek out other things which have exactly the same problems as you have. So not only do you have your own birth to contend with, your own suffering to contend with, but you're actually multiplying that suffering manifold by also seeking other things which are in exactly the same category and which have exactly the same problem. And that's why it's called the ignoble search. You're in fact searching for suffering rather than searching for the end of suffering. This is basically the meaning here. So you're looking for suffering when you're looking for these things which are subject to birth. And you can see the whole list here. First of all, you have people, and you have animals. It's pretty obvious how birth is related in that case. Then you have gold and silver. Well, you can take this metaphorically to mean gold and silver come into being. They get created by, in the first place, obviously by nuclear, supernovas, that kind of stuff, nuclear reactions. But also, in a sense of money, gets made by a bank or whatever. So they're subject to birth in a metaphorical sense. And so that's why he says here, these acquisitions or these belongings are subject to birth. And then he says, one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, utterly committed to them, means you have craving for these things. You are attached to these things. Basically, you are attached to suffering because these things are subject to birth. So you have craving for suffering is what he's saying here. That is why it is an ignoble search, because you're searching, you're craving, you're attached to that which is suffering, basically. Then comes the second aspect here. And what may be said to be subject to old age? I should warn you here that the actual proper translation here, the Pali word is jara. It actually means old age, not aging. It's an important distinction there. Old age, the way it is described in the suttas, is like, brokenness of teeth, gray hair, wrinkled skin, and all these things. It's very obvious that it means old age and not just aging. So what are subject to old age? Wife and children are subject to old age. Men and women slaves are subject to old age. Goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to old age. These belongings are subject to old age. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to old age, seeks what is also subject to old age. So again, you can see the same thing here again. You have old age is obviously one of the sufferings in life. You get old, you get weak, you don't function properly anymore. And instead of actually trying to find a solution to that suffering, you're seeking other things which have exactly the same characteristic. They also are going to suffer because of for that reason. So you're actually searching again for suffering rather than escape from a suffering. And that's why this is part of the ignoble search. And you are tired, committed, you crave and are attached to these things which get old. And what may be said to be subject to sickness? Wife and children are subject to sickness, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sickness. These belongings are subject to sickness. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sickness, seeks what is also subject to sickness. You see there that for the first time, the gold and silver has been left out because, I suppose, it's not really subject to sickness. And then there comes death, the next one. And what may be said to be subject to death? Wife and children are subject to death, men and women slaves. Goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to death. These belongings are subject to death. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. So again, death obviously is one of those big sufferings in life, one of the big problems that we're all facing. And again, instead of trying to solve that problem, trying to find an end to this problem, again, you're seeking all these other things which are in exactly the same category again. All these other things which are going to die, pass away, disappear. You're searching for them rather than finding a solution to the problem. And what may be said to be subject to sorrow? Wife and children are subject to sorrow. Men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sorrow. These acquisitions are subject to sorrow. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sorrow, seeks what is also subject to sorrow. And what may be said to be subject to defilement? Wife and children are subject to defilement, men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephant, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to defilement. These acquisitions, these belongings, in other words, are subject to defilement, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to defilement, seeks what is also subject to defilement. This is the ignoble search. So by defilement here, obviously the main meaning of this is the mental defilements that we have, whether it's greed, hatred, or delusion. And all of these things are subject to that. And you also have the gold and silver here, which are subject to defilement in the sense of impurities in gold and silver. And sometimes you get ripped off because you're told that this is gold, and in fact it isn't. And then you see that these things are also subject to defilement and impurities. You never really know what they are 100%, with certainty. So in all of these cases, basically it's about understanding suffering. All of these things here are aspects of suffering. And in all of these cases, instead of finding a solution to suffering, you're going out into the world, gathering more suffering for yourself by adding to what you already have with your own five khandhas. You're acquiring other stuff as well, as if the five khandhas wasn't enough. Yeah, rajata can also be understood as currency, as money. But in this case, it is not entirely clear what it meant, what it actually means. It could be either one of those. Yeah. Okay. Then we have the noble search coming next. So this is obviously the opposite of what we have just seen. And the Buddha says, and what is the noble search? Here, someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. being himself subject to old age, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age, he seeks the freedom from old age, supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, or nibbana, if you like. Being himself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, he seeks the freedom from sickness, supreme security from bondage, nibbana, or extinguishment. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the freedom from death, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the freedom from sorrow, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the freedom from defilement, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. This is the noble truth. So I'll take you back to the beginning of this paragraph. I'll just point out a few things here. First of all, someone is himself subject to birth. That's obvious. It just means that you are subject to birth. Now, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, now this is one of those very common Pali words called adinava. Adinava means danger. It means that you understand the suffering that is inherent in something. And the Buddha always talked about three things which come together, and that is the asada, which is like the gratification or the happiness that comes from something. Then there is the adinava, the danger in something. And then there is the nisarana. The nisarana is the escape or getting away from that particular thing. So the point here is that when you understand the gratification or the happiness in something, you also understand the danger, and you realize that the danger is much greater than the gratification or happiness, then you seek for the escape. And this is what the Buddha does here. He has understood that the danger is much greater than any gratification you can have. And because of understanding the danger, understanding the suffering in what is subject to birth, he then seeks the release. And that is what is the next thing here, is that you're seeking the release. He seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, because he understands that this is suffering. He wants to get out from that. It says here, the translation here, he seeks the unborn. In fact, I would argue that the correct translation here is not the unborn, but it's actually the freedom from birth. If you say something like the unborn, or you say things like the deathless, which is used afterwards, you give a sense of like a state, of some kind of, almost like a state of being, that you attain something, the deathless state. It sounds like a state, the unborn. But the point here is that the Buddha understands that birth is suffering. Now, if you understand that birth is suffering, what you are looking for is freedom from birth. You're not looking for some unborn state. You're looking for freedom from the suffering, which is freedom from birth. That's what you're actually looking for. And quite literally, the Pali actually has that. It's like a negative of birth, ajata, not suffering, lack of suffering, devoid of suffering, empty of suffering. So what he's seeking here is freedom from suffering, is my preferred translation of that. So he seeks the freedom, freedom from birth, rather. He seeks the freedom from birth. Supreme security from bondage. This is like a synonym for nibbana. Bondage is the being bound to samsara. The binding agent is craving. That is what binds you to samsara. And by eliminating that craving, you gain security from that bondage, because the bond has been broken. You're no longer bound to samsara, and you are, for that reason, you attain the supreme security, which is nibbana. And even nibbana, I find sometimes, if you use the word nibbana rather than translating it, it gives a sense maybe of a state, somewhere you go and where you can be happy ever after. But actually, for an Indian in those days who heard the word nibbana, what would they hear? They would hear extinguishment. That's what they would hear, or extinguishing. Because nibbana means the extinguishing of defilements, first of all, and then the complete extinguishing of the five khandhas at a later stage. So that's what they would have heard when they heard the word nibbana, extinguishment. What we hear is nibbana, and it doesn't really mean anything to us, and it may sound like some kind of state. And then you have the same thing with all of the other ones here. You have aging. Again, I translate it as a freedom instead of calling it the unaging. The freedom from old age, I feel, is a preferred translation there. And then you have the freedom from sickness, the freedom from death, the freedom from sorrow, and lastly, the freedom from defilement. And of course, the freedom from defilement, that is the first aspect of nibbana. When you become an arahant, fully enlightened, you gain that freedom from defilements. That is the first aspect here. So what we are talking about here, when the Buddha says that he's seeking these things, is that he's seeking basically that freedom which comes from arahantship, essentially. Although he doesn't know this at this time, he doesn't know exactly what he's searching for, because he hasn't attained it yet. He has a general idea of what is suffering, and he's going for the ending of that suffering. Yeah. Okay, everybody happy with that? Make sense? Yeah? Yes? I think it's, I think it's a metaphorical defilement. It's not a defilement in the mind like we normally talk about. It's just a material defilement. Lack of purity of gold. That's what's called defilement here. It's a different type. It's just used in a different way, basically. You can expand this list to basically include almost anything, So it could possibly be, I think the word upadi here, which is translated acquisitions here, which I call belongings instead, usually means like material things, things that you own, usually. That's the list you have here. But I think according to the commentaries, it also means like the five khandhas, for example. So you're attached to the five khandhas, which obviously also includes mental states. So it's a little bit ambiguous. So it could conceivably also mean attachment to your work. It could conceivably mean attachment to anything, I think, actually. So you can certainly include that. I suspect that these things here are probably maybe the things that are closest to you. You start off with wife and children, the things that you're most attached to, and then it has those things which are most important to you probably. Okay, so and then we come for the actual search for enlightenment. So the Buddha continues, because before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the freedom from birth, supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Suppose that myself being subject to old age, to sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the freedom from old age, the freedom from sickness, the freedom from death, the freedom from sorrow, the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. So here, you can see here, it's interesting because the Buddha starts off by saying that he basically is just like an ordinary person. He's saying here that being myself subject to birth, I sought what was also subject to birth. So in other words, he was seeking for those things that most people seek for in the world, for wife, for children. And we all know that he had a wife and a child, and yet he lived in very prosperous circumstances. There's a sutta which talks about him having a house, for the one house for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rainy season. So he was also seeking for these things, just like we are. And this is one of those places in the suttas where you see the humanity of the Buddha, just like everybody else. And you would have expected that if he really was somebody who had practiced for eons and eons and eons, he might have looked at these things differently already. But he didn't. He actually did have those attachments and cravings, just like everybody else. So that is, I find that quite interesting here. You see that he is in the same predicament that most people are in. I should also maybe comment briefly here on the very top phrase here. He talks about before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, bodhisattva in Sanskrit, that's what the word we normally hear, the Pali word is bodhisattva. What does this mean in the context of the suttas? And what it means, you find that in the suttas, I think with maybe with one or two exceptions, bodhisattva means the time before the Buddha became the Buddha, while he was in this world striving to become a Buddha, or in his last life, even if he wasn't striving, in his very last life, that is when he was a bodhisattva. That's when he was a bodhisattva. So it only relates to the very last life of the Buddha in the suttas. The only exception that I'm aware of is Majjhima Nikaya 123, further back here, the Acharya Abhuta Sutta, where the Buddha also talks about himself being a bodhisattva in the immediate previous life, in the Tusita heavenly realm. But that sutta is a little bit, in my opinion, a little bit uncertain. Comparative studies of the suttas, I think, show that that sutta has many aspects which are not authentic. So I think that it's fair to say that, if anything, the Buddha only talked about himself being a bodhisattva in his very last life. But there's more to it than that. And the other thing which is interesting here is that in the Chinese agamas, which are parallel to the Pali suttas here, this term, while I was only an unenlightened bodhisattva, doesn't occur at all. So it is possible that this entire thing is actually a later addition to the sutta, and that actually the Buddha never talked about himself as being a bodhisattva at all. That this may have come in later on under the influence of ideas that arose after the Buddha passed away. And this is one of those things, and I've seen quite a number of papers about this. I read one recently from a very well-known German scholar. He's also a monk, and I know him quite well personally, actually. And he wrote a paper about how the idea of the Buddha started to become deified after he died. And he's basically arguing that this is a kind of standard thing that happens in almost any, not only religions, but anywhere in the world, that when somebody who's been very dear to many people, very close to many people, when they pass away, they're like a vacuum occurs, because suddenly your teacher is gone. And what a standard thing that happens is that you start to deify that person. You start to give him all these kind of supernatural qualities that he didn't have before, because you miss that person so much. And you write books, let's think now, what are the qualities? Oh yeah, I remember this miracle, I remember all these kind of things. And slowly but surely, because of that pressure of glorifying the Buddha, you get ideas such as the bodhisattva ideal. And then sometimes they can even enter the actual canon, possibly, in certain cases. And there are certain suttas in the Chinese canon, in the Chinese agamas, which you don't find any parallel in the Pali, which actually talk about things which are only found in the Pali commentaries about the Buddha taking bodhisattva vows a long, long time ago, and these kind of things. I actually crept into the suttas in some of the Chinese suttas in the agamas. So it is possible that this whole idea of bodhisattva is a late addition to the sutta and to parallel suttas in the Pali canon, because it does not exist in the Chinese parallel. It just means that, bodhisattva, the word, the word satta can mean being, yeah. And bodhi means awakening. So it means like the being who is going searching for awakening, yeah. The awakening being, basically, is what it means. So the idea is just that he's, you know, searching for awakening, basically, yeah. There is also another etymology of that word, which I have forgotten now, which is bodhisatta, which somebody suggested a while ago, which I cannot remember exactly what that means. It's a Sanskrit word. So that, there is uncertainty, basically, about exactly what it means. But most people take it to mean awakening being, as in a being searching for awakening. Not really, because you're only searching for awakening if you have an idea of awakening, right? You actually have to have this idea that you're practicing the path. You cannot really say that everybody has that idea. So you could call us all bodhisattvas. Is that what you mean? Yeah, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Okay, yeah, I guess we could. I could say we're all bodhisattvas in that sense, because we're searching for awakening. Yeah, yeah. You've got to be careful though, because it has many other meanings as well. You might confuse people if you go around saying you're bodhisattva. You're right. It doesn't mean, it just, you know, as I said, nobody knows exactly what it means. But it is essentially in the suttas, it is only used ever of the Buddha in his last life before he awakened. That's the only use it has in all of the suttas. So that's basically the meaning of it. But as far as the meaning is concerned, you probably could say that, you know, if you are serious about searching for Nibbana, you are probably bodhisattva. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Yes. No, the meeting with Sumedha is that was under the Buddha Dipankara, and that was the first of the legendary sequence of 24 Buddhas. But that is just pure legend, and you find that only in the commentaries and that sort of thing. The only sutta reference you have to the Buddha meeting a past Buddha is in the Gatikara Sutta, where the Buddha is supposed, or the Buddha to be is supposed to have met Kassapa Buddha in a past life. Yeah, that's the only one. There are disagreements about it. Some people say that it might not be here. Other people would argue that it is. So with so many things, there's always some uncertainty. You know, if you have only one sutta like that, it's always going to be some grounds for uncertainty. Well, the whole thing about vows and things is all post-canonical, commentarial stuff. There's nothing at all in the sutta anywhere about that. Except for this one sutta in the Chinese Agamas, which has brought that in. But that's, you know, most scholars would argue that it's a later addition to those suttas in the Agamas. Yeah. Not really. It's not clear. Okay. Good. Everybody happy now? It's good to have a bit of discussion, actually. I quite like that. So please don't be afraid to ask. So the Buddha is now setting out to search for these things. And he's obviously saying, well, if I'm subject to these kind of defilements, if I'm subject to all these kind of sufferings, then the right thing to do is for me to search for an end of these sufferings, birth, old age, etc., etc. And you would notice here, one thing which is quite interesting here as well, he actually says, then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? And then he says, suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage and Nibbana. And the interesting thing here is that in the traditional story of the Buddha, you hear about him being a bodhisattva, searching for enlightenment to help all beings. But there's nothing about that here at all. All he's saying here is that, well, I am immersed in suffering. I have a problem. Let me seek a solution to that problem for myself. That is what he's saying here. And this is, if anything is authentic about the Buddha's life story, it is this part right here. Not so much the legends and mythology you hear afterwards. So the Buddha here sees that there is a problem and he wants to find a solution to that problem. He does not say anything about other beings at this particular point. And you can see why that is the case. Why would you want to go out and try to seek a solution for other beings when you haven't even found a solution for yourself yet? First of all, you have to find out whether there is a solution. And then you can start about thinking about helping others. It makes very good sense that it has to have this kind of sequence here. So, having thought in this way, the Buddha then goes and is moved to actually become a monk, basically, to become an ascetic. So he says, later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise, and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So here you see the Buddha's renouncing. This is one of the few places where the Buddha actually talks about how the renunciation of the household life happened. And it starts off with saying, while I was a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life. And the point, the reason why the Pali has that, the point is that it's not in ancient India at the time. It was very common for the Brahmins. They would live the first part of life in a household life. They would maybe have a wife. They would have children. They would enjoy sensuality for the first 40, 50 years or whatever of life. And then they would renounce. And then they would live a life of an ascetic after that. In other words, they would wanted to have the cake and eat it at the same time. So they wanted both sensuality and the blessings of renunciation. But the point that the Buddha is making here, the point that this sutta is making, is that there is no point in living that home life for 40, 50 years and enjoying sensuality because it is suffering. This is the whole point about this previous paragraph, about all these things about sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Why would you want to attach yourself to all these things? Partner, children, house, all these kind of things, when you understand that there is a problem to be overcome. And that's why even in the prime of life, even while you're at the best of your youth, it is still right to go forth. You shouldn't wait till you're old and I was about to say decrepit, maybe not quite that old, but you shouldn't wait till you're old. Now is the right time to go out and actually renounce that life. That is the point here. He is, in a sense, saying something more than what was the common attitude at the time. And then he says here that though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces. So here you can see that the common mythology and legend of the Buddha is that he left in the middle of the night while his wife and his son were sleeping and just disappeared, in a sense, which many people have pointed out. It seems a little bit, not very proper thing to do. It seems a bit, lacking a responsibility, perhaps. But he didn't actually do that. You see right here that his mother and father wished otherwise. He obviously had discussed it with his family. He obviously had to make sure that both his wife and his child were taken care of, and he had discussions with them. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had a chance to wish otherwise and weep with tearful faces. So it is actually, the real story is actually quite different from what you read in the legendary stuff. And that makes sense to me. It makes good sense to me that he would have discussed this with his family and told them of his wish, and that they were obviously sad to see him leave because he obviously was a very dear and beloved son. So then, having done that, he shaves off his hair and beard and puts on the yellow robe. So he becomes a monk. It's important to be aware of that. He's not different from the other monks. The Buddha is a monk just like the rest of the Sangha. And he went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, bhikkhus, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, the Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that the wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. So you have here the Buddha going out in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, Santivarapada in Pali. This kind of expression later on would come to mean Nibbana later on. But this point here, it obviously doesn't mean Nibbana, it just means that he's seeking for something peaceful and beautiful. The highest possible peace, the elimination of all these things that he has seen are troublesome in life, death, defilements, illness, etc. This is what he's seeking for here. It's interesting here that the meaning of this word here is different from what it is later on. And this is something I want to get back to afterwards, is that the way the Buddha speaks before his enlightenment, the usage of the word there, they conform to the way those words were used in Indian society at the time. But after his enlightenment, he gives these words new meanings. And they, like the jhanas and arahant and all these things, these are ancient words that existed at the time of the Buddha, before his enlightenment. And then he applies new meaning to these words so that they get a kind of specific Buddhist meaning afterwards. And that's important to realize that, because I will show you afterwards why this is important and how this comes into this story later on. So then he learns the teaching of Alara Kalama, first of all, the doctrines, just as we are doing here today, understanding what the teaching is about. And then only when you have understood the teaching, what it is about, do you actually start applying yourself. So that is what comes next. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly, Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge, you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, Friend Alara Kalama, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend, replied Alara Kalama. So here you see the Buddha is following the practice at that time in Indian society. He's following Alara Kalama's teaching. And according to this, he is realizing here what is called here the base of nothingness. Now, it is very interesting. What is the Buddha actually realizing here? What is it? What is this base of nothingness? And you find that in later Buddha's teachings, the base of nothingness is one of the immaterial attainments, is one of the things that you attain after the jhanas. It is something, a very, very lofty state of samadhi. So the question is that what it means here, or does it actually mean something else? And the problem, if it actually means this in this context, it creates a problem for the Buddha's biography, because later on in his life, the Buddha practices austere practices. After having practiced the austere practices, then he remembers as a child reaching the first jhana, and he tells himself that this first jhana is the path to enlightenment. He understands that this is the way to enlightenment. So the question arises, well, if the Buddha did realize this, the base of nothingness, quite recently before his enlightenment, why does he have to remember all the way back to his childhood experience when he attained the first jhana? That is the question that arises. Some people, they argue that, well, just because you have attained the base of nothingness, it doesn't mean that you have attained the first jhana. They say you can bypass the jhanas and go straight into the immaterial realms. Now, I don't know. To me, that seems like doesn't seem right. If you read the suttas, it is always a sequential, it's a gradual calming of the mind. You cannot make this kind of quantum leaps. You have to gradually calm it down to enter things like the base of nothingness. I can't make any sense of that kind of argument personally here. Another argument is that, well, the reason why the Buddha had to go back to his childhood attainment was because these attainments here, they were conjoined with the wrong view. Because the view of these people was that this would lead to a certain rebirth in the future, and that was the highest happiness you would have. And because the Buddha later on rejected this particular teaching, he would not be able to use that in his memory as something which he could use for enlightenment, because he assumed that this was wrong view, basically, to start with. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? I'm not sure if I'm expressing myself all that well. But the point is that he assumed that this base of nothingness, because the Dhamma that was taught by Lara Kalama was a Dhamma that, according to Buddha's teaching, was wrong view, he rejected that, and that's why he couldn't really remember it afterwards, because he assumed that it was a wrong view teaching. And maybe that is true. That is a possible explanation. But my personal explanation for this, the one I like to use, and it's purely speculative, I'm quite happy to admit that, but my explanation is that this does not mean the base of nothingness as the immaterial realms, as it later on becomes in the Buddha's teachings. The base of nothingness here is something else. It is a type of samadhi that was known in Indian society at the time of the Buddha. And then the Buddha takes that name and uses it in his own system of meditation later on. Just like the Buddha takes words like jhana, which means something else before his enlightenment, he takes words such as arahant, he takes words such as, just mentioned before, santivara padang, and then they become nibbana in his teaching. In the same way, he takes this word and uses it later on. But in this context, because we're talking before the enlightenment, it doesn't actually mean the base of nothingness. It means something else that was practiced at that time in Indian society here. Yes, Jacob. It could mean something like that, yeah, because like nothing, you have nothing in your mind, so it could mean like a kind of a peaceful state of samadhi, yeah? Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah. That is certainly one possibility, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, the base is, the part of the word is ayatana. It just means like a sphere or a, you know, it's like a mental sphere, essentially. Yeah. You enter a certain state, that's what it normally means. So, it could mean anything. I mean, there's no, basically, the commentaries actually say that it means the immaterial attainment. That's what the commentaries say. Yeah. But I'm not entirely convinced that's the case, because the commentaries already, they are a systematization of the Dhamma. So you don't actually, sometimes they get issues wrong. I think that's pretty clear from modern research that they actually do that. So anyway, it is these things are uncertain, and this is just my kind of personal pet theory, and you can look into that if you like. But I find it an interesting way of looking at this particular situation. And it certainly explains how it was that the Buddha could attain this base of nothingness, and yet later on he actually had to remember the first jhana he attained as a child instead of remembering this particular thing here. And then he says, just after that, he says that not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have these things. And again, you will probably recognize these five factors as the five spiritual faculties or the five spiritual powers. So again, you can see that the Buddha already at this time was using categories that he was later on going to use in his actual teaching. So the five spiritual faculties already are, in a sense, at the front of his mind. It is actually interesting here that in the Chinese version of this sutta, and also in many other versions which parallel this particular sutta, mindfulness and concentration are not part of the list. All this says is, I too have faith, energy, and wisdom. Now, if the Buddha really did attain the base of nothingness, which is one of the highest states of samadhi you can attain, then you would have expected him to have mindfulness and samadhi on that list as well. If mindfulness and samadhi are not there, it could be an indication that this is not the actual base of nothingness, perhaps. Anyway, there's a little bit more speculation for you, just to make it more interesting. Okay. Is everybody happy with that? Does that make sense to people? Okay. And then he goes back to Alara Kalama, as I just read out, and he asks him, well, have I attained what you are teaching? And Alara Kalama confirms, yes, you have attained that. And then the Buddha says to Alara Kalama, it is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. And Alara Kalama responds, it is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare, I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abiding by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare, I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. So a very honorable man is Alara Kalama. As soon as somebody else reached the same state, he actually invites him to lead the community together. Thus, Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself, and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to the reappearance in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So here the Buddha is realizing that this Dhamma, presumably, the theoretical teaching of this Dhamma is that if you practice in this way, you will get reborn in this particular plane, the base of nothingness. I understand here that that is a plane which corresponds to whatever attainment the base of nothingness means previously. It may not necessarily correspond to the immaterial attainments as we normally talk about them. But he understands that because it leads to rebirth, it is not what he is looking for. You see the whole sequence here, disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, Nibbana. This is the kind of language that he uses later on in his teachings, which becomes very, very important in his teachings later on. The word disenchantment here, Nibbida, is a word which Ajahn Brahm translates with like repulsion very commonly. And I think that there is actually very good evidence in the suttas for translating it with repulsion. Why repulsion? Well, because you are repelled by samsara. When you see the suffering, you get repelled by it. And it's that repelling by it, the mind pushes away samsara. You don't want to have anything to do with it anymore. It's that repelling which actually makes it possible for you to gain release and make an end of craving. So I think repulsion there makes sense. And there are several contexts in the suttas that I have noted where repulsion is actually a very good translation for this word. Okay, so he is dissatisfied and he leaves and he moves on. So he continues, still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and said to him, friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Uddaka Ramaputta replied, the Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that the wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma, as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma? In reply, Uddaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So in other words, Uddaka Ramaputta is saying here that the teaching, the theoretical teaching that he's teaching corresponds to this base of neither perception nor non-perception. And again, I say that this is not necessarily equivalent to the fourth immaterial attainment of the Buddha's teachings. I would rather say that this is a attainment that was known at the time, whose name the Buddha then later on uses and imports into his own system, and he calls it the fourth immaterial attainment. That is my reading of this. It doesn't actually refer to that. Alternatively, it could perhaps refer to that, but you would still have to explain why the Buddha then recalled the first jhana later on. There's an interesting thing here which you will maybe note, and that is that in the previous sutta, the Buddha was talking to Alara Kalama, and Alara Kalama was himself the person who attained the base of nothingness. Now, in this sutta, the Buddha is talking to Uddaka Ramaputta, but Ramaputta quite literally means the son of Rama. So here, it is Rama who is the teacher. Rama is presumably somebody who has passed away, and it is actually this Rama who did arrive at this base of neither perception or non-perception. It is a slight, it's a funny little thing here in this sutta that they actually find this distinction here between the two. And some people have made the point that, well, why does this sutta have like this slight distinction? Why is it in one case he's talking to the actual spiritual master himself? In the second case, he's talking to the son of the spiritual master, and the spiritual master has passed away. Why can that be? What is going on here? And that what they are saying, what somebody pointed out was that, well, if this was just legendary, if this was just myth, then surely such details as that would never have been included. They don't make any sense. So the only way that this can be understood, why it is said in this way, is because it is very likely to be historical. This is the way it actually was. And that's why such little details as the fact that he was the son of Rama, rather than Rama himself, are included in this way. I find that a very interesting argument, because sometimes you find people arguing all kinds of strange things, and that is a nice argument to show that this is very likely, perhaps, to be historical, exactly as it says here. So, the Buddha then says, I considered not only Rama, in other words, the fellow who passed away, had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge? That is the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, says the Buddha to be, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. And Uddaka Ramaputta replies, It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life, the brahmacharya, the holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared and entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. As Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. So you can see here, because the spiritual master Rama has passed away, and because the Buddha-to-be has attained the same attainment that spiritual master taught, he's now saying, well, you lead the community because you have now attained the same attainment, which is different from the previous one, because in the previous teacher, Alara Kalama said, well, let's lead it together because we obtained the same thing. Now here the Buddha-to-be is superior, and that's why he's asked to take over the whole community here. So you see the slight difference here, which is interesting here. Then Uddaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to extinguishment, in other words, Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So again, I understand here that the reappearance in the base of neither perception, non-perception, this obviously refers to rebirth, does not refer to the fourth immaterial attainment. Rather, it refers to a particular state of samadhi that was attainable at that time, before the time of the Buddha. And he realized because it leads to rebirth, it doesn't lead to the cessation of birth, because it leads to all these things. He was not satisfied with that teaching, because he was searching for the end of birth, right? So then he goes on. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually arrived at the Sena Nigama near Uruvela. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and a nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. So here the Buddha now is coming towards his enlightenment, and he is he's basically come to the stage where he's looking here for a nice place where he can practice by himself. He has given up the teachers that exist at the time of the Buddha, at the time in India, because those teachings are not able to take him all the way to enlightenment, to the end of rebirth. He gives those up, and now he strives on his own. I find it quite instructive here that even the Buddha-to-be, you know, like the supreme being that we can consider in this universe as far as Buddhist is concerned, even he has teachers before he sets out by himself. It is beautiful, isn't it? I mean, you have this kind of person who obviously has very powerful spiritual abilities. He doesn't just go out there and say, oh, I'm good enough, I can do this on my own, I have all the right qualities. It's not some kind of ego trip. He actually is humble enough to realize, well, let me learn as much as I possibly can from existing spiritual masters. And this is a very important lesson, because essentially most people are just in that boat, in the same boat. Most of us will realize that there are people out there who are more accomplished spiritually than we are. And it's important to use those teachers as far as we can before we sort of set out on our own kind of own path somewhere. So we get the maximum benefit from the teachers that exist before we practice on our own. It's a very important thing. And even the Buddha, the most spiritually adept person in this eon perhaps, or whatever however you want to look at it, even he did that. So certainly other beings should do exactly the same. I'm always very concerned when I read stories about some kind of self-enlightened master somewhere who's done everything by himself, never had a teacher, and he's just practicing on his own somewhere. I'm always concerned about that, because there's somebody, to me, it sort of has a sign of not having enough humility, not having enough common sense to understand that we actually need teachers, we actually need to help the help we can get, to take us as far as it possibly can before we set out on our own. So this is very important. There is another aspect as well of that, and that is in monastic life. There was a sutta I was reading the other day, maybe a couple of weeks ago or something, where Upali was the master of the Vinaya at the time of the Buddha, and he goes to the Buddha and he says, Venerable Sir, I would like to go off on my own and practice meditation somewhere far away in the forest by myself. And the Buddha says to Upali, now Upali is one of the leading disciples of the Buddha, right? The Buddha says to Upali, you should not go off anywhere and practice on your own until you see the following qualities within yourself. The qualities, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. When you see those qualities within yourself, then you can go off and practice on your own. Until then, you should live at ease within the Sangha. And again, the point here is that until you get to that stage, very, profound meditation, profound samadhi, you are liable to slide away, to misunderstand, to not know what you're doing, to end up with sloth and torpor and defilements polluting your mind. It's only at that stage that you have enough strength in your practice to be able to go off on your own, basically. Another place the Buddha also said that you can end up going mad if you spend too much time by yourself without enough samadhi first. So here the Buddha has come to the Magadhan country, and he's found this. Notice here how he also describes this place that he has found. He describes it as a beautiful piece of land. It's agreeable, it's delightful. It has a river nearby, so presumably it's a place where he can wash or he can get water from. He has a village nearby for alms resort. It's a delightful grove. In other words, it's not some kind of ascetic practice. This is the middle way. He's away from the sensual life of the world, but also not some kind of supreme ascetic practice. It's just that place that is conducive for striving, where you're neither unpleasant nor are you indulging in sensuality. And this will serve for striving, he says. It is already almost 20 past. I was going to go on a little bit longer. What do people feel? Anybody want to get away, or have you had enough, or do you want to stop there? Okay. I'm just concerned that it's going to be impossible to finish it next time as well if I don't go on a little bit longer. Maybe I'll do one more paragraph, Jacob, if that's okay with you. If you want to go, please do so. It's pretty much the same. So please don't feel bad about leaving if you want to leave, if you can't do it. I think I just have to do so, otherwise I won't be able to finish next time either. So I've got to push things a little bit here. Attached to, Right, Right, exactly, It's true, isn't it? Because again, it's about, that's what you need. You need that kind of place to be able to function properly, in a spiritual practice. Yeah, indeed. Okay, so now we come to the Buddha's enlightenment. He has found this place that is suitable for striving. And now comes that part where he actually realizes this thing that he's searching for. Then bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, I attained the freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to old age, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age, seeking the freedom from old age, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, I attained the freedom from old age, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to illness or sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the freedom from sickness, supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, I attained the freedom from sickness, the supreme security from bondage, nibbana. And then he goes on with the same for death, the same for sorrow, and this, lastly, for defilement. So seeking the freedom from death, he finds the freedom from death, nibbana. Seeking the freedom from sorrow, he finds the freedom from sorrow, nibbana. And lastly, being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment, I attained the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. So this is obviously, he doesn't really explain exactly what he did here. That you find that in the other suttas. All he says is that he did find the solution to what he was searching for. He did find an end to all those sufferings. Of course, one of the very interesting things here is that when he does that, the knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. So you know, if you're an arahant, you know with absolute certainty that you will not be reborn again. That is part of the knowledge of arahantship. And this is important. And this is the thing, one of those things that you see again and again and again in the suttas, that whenever somebody becomes enlightened, what they always say is, this is my last birth. This, there is no renewal of being. It's just another way of saying that there is no more birth. And that is all they say. In other words, the purpose of this path, the purpose of becoming an arahant, the purpose of being a Buddha, is to end suffering, is to end birth. This is synonymous. Ending suffering, ending birth are synonymous in the suttas. And this is the only thing that you ever find when somebody becomes fully enlightened. This is all they ever say. No more birth in the future. So this is the purpose. This is what this whole path is about, ending rebirth. And I always find it very strange when people try to argue that, you know, rebirth is have a kind of Buddhism without rebirth. I mean, if you have Buddhism without rebirth, then what all the arahants find when they become fully enlightened is completely untenable. In other words, you take away the purpose of the whole Buddhist path if you don't have any rebirth. Buddhism is no more without rebirth. There is nothing there. There is a few nice methods for meditation. There's a few nice methods for leading a good life, for being kind and gentle, and for having a reasonably pleasant life in this existence. But that is not the core of the Buddha's teachings. It's about ending rebirth. And this is the knowledge that happens when you become an arahant. My deliverance is unshakable. This means that once you become fully enlightened, there is no way back again. You can never again have a defiled mind. You can never again regress from what you have attained. There's no way backwards. You are freed from that thing. Okay, I think that might be a good place to stop, actually, because it's getting late already. So are there any last questions or comments before we call it a day? Anybody want to say anything? Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, so let's pay homage to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.